This podcast is a part of Sphera,
a collective of independent media outlets from across Europe.
For more information,
visit sphera-hub.com.
Hello from the continent of discontent. It doesn't feel like Europe is a very happy place this week, although we will do our best to cheer people up a little bit. Dominic, I see people have been setting fire to bicycles over there in the Netherlands. That doesn't seem great.
Yeah, and letting off fireworks at police officers and police officers shooting back. It's been pretty bad.
It's grim. For once, France is not the place that is like rioting the hardest, for which I'm grateful. Not that it's a competition.
Everything's a competition with you, Katie.
Anyway, it's generally grim out there. And for those of you listening from Austria, we are thinking of you, especially this week. Can't believe you guys are under lockdown again. Hope everyone's doing okay. Let's just try in general to make some progress with the whole vaccination boostery thing. Yeah?
Okay. It'd be nice if they gave it to us here in the Netherlands. Anyway, we're not meant to be talking about this. This is a podcast where we don't talk about the pandemic.
Yeah, sorry. What are we talking about this week?
Well, this week we're going to be talking about Facebook. You remember that like social media tech giant that we all used to be a member of? Actually, I am still a member of it. I'm pretending to be cool like I left it. I didn't.
Dominic still logs in every day.
Yeah, I'm still a member. But I am a member along with 423 million other monthly users in Europe. I have to say I have questioned it though, because Facebook has been in the news a lot with quite a lot of negative coverage recently, in large part due to the whistleblowing testimony of former Facebook employee Frances Haugen, who has actually been in Europe recently, and Katie even got to meet her, I believe.
But yeah.
More about that later. This week, we're going to be speaking about what Frances Haugen's testimony means for Europe and what Europe's legislation around tech looks like. So this week, we're going to be speaking to Guillermo Baltra, head of the digital team at the Open Society European Policy Institute, and he'll be telling us about the European tech policies and whether or not they are doing enough.
But first,
Katie, who's had a bad week?
Well, we've actually got a bit of a space and technology theme this week, not just with a technology-themed interview, but a special space edition of Good Week, Bad Week. Why restrict ourselves to one continent? Let us zoom out a bit and go to outer space. And I'm going to kick things off with Bad Week, which goes to Russia for blowing up one of their own satellites and endangering the crew on the International Space Station in the process.
And so the Russians did this on purpose. They blew up a satellite on purpose. It wasn't an accident.
Oh, yes. It was very much on purpose. This was a missile test. It was Russia firing a missile from the ground and using it to target one of its own satellites. Thankfully, the test was a success, because just imagine if it hit like the wrong thing. The target was an old Soviet satellite that's been up there since 1982 and used to be used for sending intelligence signals, but it's been dead for a few decades. In terms of the missile itself, Russia is one of a very small number of countries that possess these super high-tech missiles capable of blowing up satellites, which is something that governments are increasingly interested in, because as technology gets more and more advanced, the idea of a war in space is getting less and less crazy. We've already got things like China developing this weapon called Shijian 17 that could reach out with this kind of robot arm thing and like scoop up a spaceship with it. And espionage in space is also already a thing. Russia has been accused of stalking American spy satellites and like following them around in space. It's no longer science fiction, all of this stuff.
Okay, so Russia isn't the only country that's messing about in space. So why did everyone get so mad about this particular event?
Well, firstly, because Russia didn't tell anyone that it was testing this missile. This is only the fourth time in history that anyone has fired a missile from the ground and successfully blown something up in space. So that rattled people, particularly Western governments, who generally don't enjoy surprises from the Russian military. The US especially got very angry about this and described it as reckless, NASA said it was outraged, and the French defense minister called the Russians space vandals, which I actually think is quite a good band name. More generally, other governments got mad about this test because it made a really big mess. As you all know, Dominic, when you explode things, stuff goes everywhere. This is also true in space. And when Russia blew up the satellite last week, it sent loads of bits of metal and other debris, like, spraying everywhere. That set off an alert at the International Space Station, which wasn't too far away. And the seven astronauts on board got woken up, and they had to follow this emergency procedure where they had to go and shelter in the spaceships that are eventually going to take them home at the end of their mission. So they had to go and sit and wait there for 2 hours. And I imagine that must have been pretty scary for the astronauts. There are actually 2 Russians among the crew on the ISS, as well as a German and 4 Americans. So it was really scary for them. The mess that this explosion caused in general is also really bad. According to the US, it created 1,500 bits of large trackable debris, but also probably hundreds of thousands of bits of smaller debris. Now, just to be clear, Russia is not the first country to be criticized for causing a mess in this way. India, the US, and China have also all previously shot down satellites, and they have also all created a bunch of space junk by doing that. And Russia denied in this case that it had actually endangered anyone. They were like, oh, come on, you guys are exaggerating. And also, we're not the only ones making a mess up here.
I actually read this week that the European Space Agency estimates there are currently 170 million fragments flying around the edge of the planet. And I also read that scientists are suggesting that we might need to find a way to make this junk, like, come together and form a huge ring around the Earth so that it's not just everywhere, so that it's in, like, a tangible place. And it would make us look a bit like Saturn, but with a ring of junk.
I can't decide whether that's really cool or really gross.
Maybe a bit of both.
I mean, in general, this space junk is a problem. It is not just stuff that's la 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 up there in the air, don't need to worry about it, it's not on Earth. We tend to think about this stuff as sort of gently floating around up there, but all of this stuff is moving really fast. So the International Space Station itself moves at about 8 kilometers a second, which is several times faster than a bullet. So if there's all of this junk up there, collisions could potentially be really, really dangerous and, like, rip into the hull of a rocket or a spaceship. The ISS itself, it's pretty solid. It's not just a tin can. However, it was built in the 90s when there was a lot less space debris. And I was reading this really interesting interview with Didier Schmidt from the European Space Agency, who was talking about how if something, like, punctures the shell, you can isolate that bit of the space station and then go and fix the hole. But if something hit, God forbid, the fuel tank, I mean, that could potentially be really, really bad. Debris that is lower down in the atmosphere kind of burns up in the atmosphere and that gets rid of it. So that's good. But yeah, if you've seen these pictures of what the Earth actually looks like as you zoom out, it is awe-inspiring to see our little tiny planet and think about how insignificant we are in the universe. But then it's also just like, oh my God, like, what a terrible mess. Humans have been going to space now and, like, putting machines up there for more than 60 years now. And so there is just, like, all of this crap orbiting us, like old bits of rocket and, like, tiny little flecks of paint, basically the sky version of kind of, you know, those microplastics.
Yeah, and also I heard that, like, due to climate change, space junk is going to become more of a problem because the higher the carbon dioxide level, the less chance there is that the debris is going to be pulled downward and incinerated as it enters the thicker atmosphere.
Yeah, exactly. So, like, all of this stuff is just going to get harder and harder. And I don't know. You know me, Dominic. I like things tidy. And all of this junk is kind of, like, making me freak out. Like, my neat freak side is, like, really freaking out about this. And obviously, you know, when it comes to climate change, there are all of these messes, like, on this planet that we need to prioritize cleaning up. But after that, we really need to get to the space junk.
Time for a tidy.
Time for a tidy. Who's had a good week?
Well, apart from what you just said, it's been a good week for the European Space Agency after European ministers met in Portugal and agreed to a new manifesto that commits Europe to accelerate its space activity. Now, I feel like space exploration and space travel has been getting a pretty bad name for itself recently. And it
really
kind of makes sense. Yeah, well, think about who the figureheads are now of space exploration. these billionaire white men, Jeff Bezos, Elon Musk, and Richard Branson.
Oh, those guys. This just goes to show how French I've become, because I was like, Thomas Pesquet, that nice French astronaut. I forgot about Elon.
He is nice. I just retweeted some really nice photos he took from space, actually. You should check him out on Twitter.
Very good photographer.
Anyway, yeah, this present-day space race between a handful of billionaires launching gas-guzzling rockets into space and promoting space tourism hasn't, at least in my influence bubble, exactly done wonders for the perception that space exploration is important or relevant to the needs of our planet and its population of mainly non-billionaires. So what this manifesto argues is that space activity is vital in the fight against climate change, in the continent's ability to respond to disasters, and to keep that infrastructure in the sky that we are so reliant on, those satellites that Katie was talking about, safe.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? I feel like sometimes it's quite hard to make a good case for giving a massive boost in public funding for like space exploration, and we have so many other problems here on the ground. What are like the specific things that the manifesto says, yeah, like we should do this and this would be really good for society?
Yeah, I agree with you. And actually this manifesto does a pretty good job at laying out three main areas of acceleration for Europe's space scene. The first one is the protection of space assets, so objects like satellites. And as we saw this week with Russia shooting a missile at, I mean, this time it was their own satellite. It's not totally unimaginable to think a country could at some point shoot a missile at another country's satellite. And that would be pretty catastrophic for those of us down here on land. But the other two accelerators are at least somewhat connected to our poor old sickly climate. One is titled Space for a Green Future.
That's got EU written all over it.
It really does. But you know what doesn't have EU all over it is the scoring they have under the YouTube videos announcing these accelerators. It's really like science fiction movie from the 1990s, maybe?
Ooh, let's hear a bit. It's quite frenetic. It's making me a bit anxious about space.
I think it's meant to be making us feel like optimistic about the future of space.
Mm.
Because in this case, the European Space Agency is arguing that it's vital to help the EU reach their goal of becoming carbon neutral by 2050. They describe Europe as the world leaders on Earth observation, and they stress that these satellites observing the Earth are absolutely key in providing the data and information that will help us model, predict, and act on climate change. They're also actually planning on making a digital twin of the Earth in order to give an accurate representation of the past, present, and future of our planet.
Oh, that sounds ambitious and nonspecific.
It does, doesn't it? It's all a bit ambitious and nonspecific, actually, if I'm honest. The other accelerator is Rapid Resilient Crisis Response, which also has generic, dramatic European Space Agency music. They stress the importance of space in managing and predicting natural disasters, things that sadly seem to inevitably be more and more likely due to you-know-what. Although the crises that space needs to respond to isn't only natural crises, but also digital crises like cyber attacks or large-scale technical failures, which are massive vulnerabilities and security concerns for Europe already and will probably become even more significant in the future.
I feel like these things are all very like worthy and important, but it's that EU thing where they've managed to take something really exciting and inspiring, aka space travel, and be like, let's put a bureaucratic spin on it and make it about boring shit.
It's so true. But in their defense, they've got that side of things covered too. On top of these three accelerators, they came up with two inspirators, which I don't think is a word.
It's not a word.
I feel inspirated by this. Anyway, so these inspirators are two rather expensive, more long-term dreams for Europe in space. The first is a plan to collect ice from the icy moons of Saturn and Jupiter.
Ooh.
There's some thought that these moons could have good conditions for life to exist. So that's the like alien hunting shit you were probably looking for. And the other inspirator is that Europe wants to be able to launch its own astronauts into space.
Oh, do we not do that?
No. At the moment, only the USA, China and Russia have that capacity, with India about to join that club. I was also surprised.
Guys, we need to catch up.
We do. Josef Aschbacher, who's the new Director General of the European Space Agency, really wants Europe to have this capacity. He argues that, apart from anything else, astronauts are such good figureheads for inspiring young people to think about space and to go into technical careers. And of course, there's always this argument about the technological advances that come from investment in space exploration that can help us in sometimes unexpected ways down here on the Earth.
It sounds fun. Also sounds kind of expensive. Like, do we know how much they're proposing that we spend on this?
No, the budget wrangling is still to come. The next ministerial council is in 12 months' time. And at that point, the ESA will need a pretty big rise in its budget, according to analysts. So yeah, we'll see how many of these things actually can happen. But this manifesto is a clear signal that European ministers are looking to improve Europe's position in the broader context of space activity. And Europe has, in recent years, been shrinking on the international space stage, with China and America and India pushing ahead. There are clearly quite some arguments that can be made about the importance of Europe retaining some heft up there in space, as Russia's destructive satellite behaviour illustrated perfectly this week.
Interesting. I'm really intrigued to see how much money goes into this, because I can't tell you how much money feels like a good amount of money and how much feels kind of obscene and like we should be spending it on problems here on the ground. But thank you very much, Dominic. I feel very inspirated. Dominic and I spent some of this weekend sending out personalized voice messages to people who signed up to donate $5 or euros a month to this podcast, which was a really nice reminder of the lovely community that listens to this show. So if you too would like to get a weird message from Dominic and me that sounds like the podcast is talking to you, you can sign up on patreon.com.
If you'd like to receive this special voicemail for us, you need to donate in the category that's from £5, dollars or euros per month. But you can also just donate two a month. We'd also be very happy with that.
Or you could donate thousands a month. I mean, there's really no upper limit.
That's true.
Who are the latest people that we have to thank?
I don't know, because you deleted the email. Have you?
Yeah, I did. So I really hope that everyone's name is on this list. If not, give us a shout and we'll give you a shout out next week. But big thanks this week go to Anthony Hildago, Joanna Sargent, Marie O'Meara, Quiva Tiernan, and Thomas Shariaria.
Thank you all so much.
In my current day job as a tech reporter, I have been writing a lot about Facebook recently. Have you heard of Facebook, Dominic?
Yes, I have heard of it. Yeah. Was that a trick question?
No, it wasn't. It does feel like lots of people of our generation, apart from you, have already abandoned Facebook, the website. I mean, frankly, I only go there to go on our Patreon group because it's a really nice place to hang out. But let us not forget that Facebook, or Meta, as it has been rebranded recently, the parent company owns Instagram and WhatsApp as well, platforms that lots of us still use every single day. Why has Facebook been in the news so much in recent weeks? Well, it is all because of a former engineer at the company, a woman called Frances Haugen, who leaked a ton of internal documents from Facebook, basically confirming a lot of stuff that we already knew. Things like how Instagram can be bad for the mental health of teenage girls. Things like the massive problem with misinformation, especially in languages that aren't English. Things like how divisive political content has in the past been displayed prominently in people's news feeds systematically by Facebook's algorithms, because the company wants to encourage us to interact with each other, and posting angry content has been one way of doing that. None of these things really came as a surprise. What has been pretty damning is the revelation that in a lot of cases, Facebook's own internal research has confirmed that these problems exist. People inside Facebook have flagged these problems up to their bosses and said, hey, like, we need to do something about this. And Facebook's bosses have not followed up on it. So there's been a lot of attention over the past few weeks on the damage that social media can do to society, making us feel bad about ourselves and, in the worst cases, particularly in the global south, countries like Myanmar and India and Ethiopia, social media can encourage people to physically attack each other. And that is terrifying. A lot of people who listen to this podcast speak smaller European languages, and you would have seen firsthand that despite Facebook setting up teams of people to fact-check things and trying to remove fake news, a lot of garbage stays up on the site, especially in smaller languages, because they're very, very English-centric, and they just don't have the resources to deal with all of this. I said this wasn't going to be a depressing episode. Listen, I'm going to get to the point. One of the things that's come up over the last few weeks, as there's been a lot of soul searching over Facebook and social media in general, is this idea of like, okay, well, what can we do with the law to make social media better? And it's been pretty interesting for me as someone who is a tech reporter, but also someone who makes a European podcast, to hear a lot of people saying, well, you know, Europe is more ahead of this on anyone. And in fact, the Facebook whistleblower herself, Frances Haugen, she has actually been on a bit of a European tour recently. And she went to Brussels, she went to London, she went to Lisbon, she went to Paris. And I actually interviewed her while she was in Paris and said, well, you know, why did you decide to come here? And she said, it's because Europe is further ahead on tech regulation than anywhere else. And I want to influence the people making it.
We did have a go at trying to explain these two big pieces of tech regulation a while back, didn't we?
Yeah, we did earlier this year. But a lot has changed since then, and not least this big conversation that we do seem to be having as a society about making social media less of a toxic place. So this week, we really wanted to take another look at those bits of legislation and whether they're going to make social media work for us as Europeans. With us to do that, in collaboration with the Open Society's European Policy Institute, is Guillermo Baltra. He is the Institute's Digital Policy Lead, and also one of our favourite European tech nerds. Can I say that?
You can.
I just did. Is there any overlap with what the whistleblower Frances Haugen has suggested we need to do to fix Facebook and the new tech policies that are being drawn up here in Europe?
Through a very important law that we call the Digital Services Act that the EU is working on, the EU will likely have very similar suggestions that what Frances is proposing. For example, the DSA will oblige the largest online platforms such as Facebook to ask themselves, what kind of societal risks do my services create? Risks related to the fundamental rights of its users, or to public health, to security, or to elections, for example. These companies will need to analyze those risks and put in place measures to mitigate them. So on that, Frances is totally on point, and hopefully the DSA will respond to what she and many others are asking. Other innovative rules that the DSA will most likely bring that Frances has been advocating for are rules that will oblige platforms like Facebook to give access to the data about how their algorithms function. And this access to this data should help regulators and researchers learn about how decisions are made inside the Facebook black box. So in that sense, hopefully, the DSA will respond to this idea that Frances is very strongly pushing for. The details about all these new measures is precisely what is being very strongly debated right now in the EU institutions as the DSA moves along the process.
Now, Europe's data protection regulation has been used by governments elsewhere as a model. Do you think it's fair to say that Europe is generally seen by the rest of the world as pretty good at designing tech legislation? And is this new legislation also going to be world-leading if it goes through?
So that's an issue that is very intensely debated. I think it's undeniable that the GDPR, Europe's main data protection law, has had a very influential impact in many parts of the world. It changed the global conversation on privacy and data protection. It pushed many other countries to adapt their own rules so that they meet the more human rights respecting standards of the GDPR. But not all tech laws in Europe are good. A suite of different copyright laws, for example, designed to benefit mainly copyright holders and the intermediaries in the copyright industry, but really without protecting users, creators, or the internet ecosystem itself, are not something to be really proud of. So it's not like we can take Europe as the tech regulator that everybody should follow. It really depends on the examples. Will the DSA be impactful globally? I think it's fair to assume that it will. Some European countries, such as France or Germany, already have laws that attempt at doing some of the things that the DSA will take care of, and countries around the world are closely following these developments. After all, I think it does make sense that for internet-related rules, we try and build similar principles around the world if we strive to build a global network that is truly borderless and truly connects the whole world.
So along with the DSA, there is a second huge bit of tech regulation on the table right now in Europe, which is the DMA, the Digital Markets Act. Can you tell us a little bit about how that piece of legislation will affect like how ordinary people in Europe use the internet?
So the Digital Markets Act, or DMA, is a law that aims to rein in the market power of a handful of gigantic companies, which the law calls digital gatekeepers. These are companies like Facebook, Apple, Google, or Amazon, which have become, by their sheer power, the kingmakers that decide who gets to succeed in the markets that they dominate. So the DMA will come in and establish rules saying that, for example, Google cannot and should not prioritize its own services artificially over those of its competitors when you search something on Google Search, or that Apple cannot force Spotify to sell its Spotify Premium service through the App Store, taking a 30% margin cut. Importantly, as another example, the DMA is very likely to introduce new interoperability obligations for this very small handful of companies. This would mean that possibly any user that is a user of the Facebook social network or of WhatsApp as a messaging app could be able to reach friends and families in other competitors of other messaging apps or other social networks without having to move to that other app or that other social network. So it would force only these big companies, not all of them, only the ones that are qualified as a digital gatekeeper, to make their services interoperable with those of the competition.
It's a really interesting idea.
Isn't it? And take email, for example. That's what, in essence, email is. Originally, you could only message a very closed set of people in your original network until somebody said, hey, why don't we just build a global standard that can speak to each other, and no matter who is your email provider, you can reach any other email in the world. Technically, it's not exactly the same, but the analogy works, because the idea is that no matter who is your social network provider or your messaging provider, you should be able to reach different audiences, break through that sort of cage of dominance that they have by just capturing all of their user base. And that's one of the things that the DMA will try to do.
It sounds like some of these policy ideas are going to have quite far-reaching effects on these tech giants. Do you get the impression that the tech giants are at all intimidated by European policymakers? I mean, especially because the EU seems to be going a bit further than other lawmakers around the world.
So one thing that Frances Haugen has clearly explained is that Facebook's main objective is to keep US regulators at bay, and has hence invested disproportionate amounts of money into improving their own systems and teams working on US-related matters and on English as the language of users. This in turn means that Facebook has left the rest of the world, and in particular the rest of languages on its platform, inadequately cared for. Facebook's continuous failings and inactions is what has provoked such a widespread strong regulatory response in Europe, but this is not since Frances has come with all her revelations, but for many years now. Europe is definitely a key market for Facebook, both economically and politically. They do not shy away from deploying as many lobbying assets as they can to try and influence the new rules to their own interest. Now, the question is whether they will succeed. I don't know, intimidated is a very strong word, but I do think that the combination of the DMA and the DSA are definitely things for Facebook to consider very, very carefully. And that is why we're seeing so much lobbying on their behalf.
And how close are we to those laws actually becoming a reality? Like, when will they actually be law?
So normally an EU co-legislative process is a moderately slow one that takes between a year and a half and 2 years to complete. But with the DSA and the DMA, the political energy is such that these laws are being negotiated at an unusually fast pace. Both laws are on track to going into what is called trilogue negotiations, which is where the European Parliament, the Council of the EU, and the European Commission sit down together, negotiate, and agree on a final text. And those trilogue negotiations will start in early 2022. The political ambition is to have a final deal between the three institutions sealed by the end of the French presidency of the EU, which runs from January through June of next year. So if all goes to plan, we will have these two laws finalized and ready to be published in the official journal of the European Union by the summer of 2022.
Okay, so there's still a bit of time until we're going to see these laws actually coming a reality. In the meantime, you mentioned lobbying. To what extent are Facebook and the other tech giants going to be able to have a chance to persuade policymakers to water down these policies at all?
Look, these are very far-reaching and vast laws. So I think it is safe to assume that many provisions will have Facebook and other tech giants imprint, as they are powerful, they are well-resourced lobbying operators in Europe and globally. I'll give you an example. Many political groups in the European Parliament have been fighting hard to get the DSA to regulate so-called targeted advertising. This is something that would hit at the core of the business model of many of these tech giants, as their businesses strive on collecting as much data as they can from their users and monetizing that data through targeted advertising mainly and through other means. They are surely fighting fiercely against any rules on how they collect this personal data. And so what will we see at the end of the process is still anybody's guess, but it's very much a moving target right now.
And in terms of the general atmosphere, I mean, people are looking at social media companies more than ever before, lawmakers, campaigners, because of this whole Facebook whistleblowing saga. Do you think that that atmosphere could lead to perhaps Europe coming up with even tougher plans than they were planning on having to try to tame the tech giants?
I think the EU realized some time ago that the internet is broken, that old problems have worsened, and that new problems emerge every day. And with it, because of these problems, democracies are at risk, because it's not only about the private sphere anymore, it's also about the public sphere and elections and the health of the public discourse and so on. And so I think the EU realized it needed to move fast and fix things. And the DSA and the DMA are part of that effort. So Frances Haugen's revelations come in just at the right moment and are incredibly useful to give EU policymakers that extra push they needed, that extra very compelling reason that helps them in their negotiations to continue working hard to finding the right answers. But it's not necessarily something that will, I guess, push them over the line in another different direction. It gives them very solid justification for many of the things that they were already doing and already thinking about doing.
Thank you very much to Guillermo for joining us this week and to our friends at the Open Society's European Policy Institute for collaborating with us on this episode. If you, like us, enjoy getting into the weeds of EU policy, but in an accessible way, I really recommend that you check out another episode that we made recently with ASEPI on EU climate policy and whether or not it's going to save us all. You will find the link in the show notes. What have you been enjoying this week?
This week, I started watching The Unlikely Murderer. Have you heard about it?
No.
It's a Netflix dramatization of the murder of Swedish Prime Minister Olaf Palme that happened in 1989. I've only seen the first two episodes so far, but I've been really gripped by it and the story of the kind of relative chaos amongst the police trying to investigate it after it happened. It's taking, I think, quite a bit of artistic license with the characters and with some of the story, but that also makes it just very captivating. So I highly recommend it. What have you been enjoying, Katie?
Well, actually, my recommendation this week comes from our aforementioned Patreon Facebook group, the only good group on that website, in my opinion. And it comes from one of our supporters, Francesca Baldassari. She recommends a new Italian animated series, also on Netflix. It is called Tear Along the Dotted Line. It's by the Italian cartoonist Zero Calcare. And it's about him like just reflecting on his life in Rome and beyond with this kind of cute giant armadillo as his conscience in physical form. Francesca says, I love his work and this animated series is not disappointing. It made me laugh and cry as per usual. Its only fault is to be too short. 6 episodes, 15 to 17 minutes each. That is the perfect length, Francesca. That's not too short.
It sounds beautiful.
It is really, really fun. I watched the first episode over lunch today and I really enjoyed it. It's very funny and sweet. So yeah, definitely recommend Tear Along the Dotted Line on Netflix.
I'm sticking with technology for our happy ending, and I'd like to tell you about an invention which this week won the coveted James Dyson Award for Sustainability. Jerry de Vos is the inventor. He's a Dutchman from the Technical University of Delft, and he was awarded the £35,000 prize for creating a handheld device that can tell you which type of plastic is used in a product.
Oh, handy.
It is handy. I mean, literally, you can hold it in your hand. As I'm sure everyone knows, there are many different types of plastic, some of which can be recycled, others which cannot. And at the moment, a lot of the sorting of different plastic waste into these categories is done by hand and is prone to human error. Yeri's invention now makes it much easier to work out which type of plastic you have and to sort it better. He's hoping that this invention will go some way to improving the situation with plastic waste. Currently, around 40% of plastic waste is sent to the landfill, 25% is incinerated, 19% dumped, and only 16% is recycled.
Not great.
So technological developments are definitely very welcome, and Jerry's invention is a small ray of hope. Congrats on your prize.
We will be back next week. In the meantime, despite all this talk about how terrible social media is, we're still glued to it over here. We can't help ourselves. Where can people find us on the terrible social media websites, Dominic?
They can find us on Twitter at EuropeansPod, Instagram, EuropeansPodcast, and Facebook by typing in The Europeans Podcast. But if you want access to that Patreon group, you will have to become a Patreon.
Tough love. This episode was produced by me and Wojciech Oleksiak, and we are part of the Are We Europe family. Find more like-minded podcasts at the link in the show notes.
We'll be back next week, as usual. In the meantime, stay safe, everyone.
Thanks for listening.